The military doesn't move you back. So they're not going to uproot you and move you back to your home. This is your home. And so you wait and you hope that your husband's okay. And that was for a year.
Hey everyone, Nathan Long here, president of Saybrook University, right here in Pasadena, California. Welcome to another episode of Saybrook Insights. My guest today is Saybrook alumna, Dr. Summer Watson. She has a Doctor of Psychology with a clinical emphasis. She's a podcaster, event producer, live show host, author, and military spouse of over 21 years. Dr. Watson is the founder of CORE Women, that's CORE with a K, and she has used that as a platform to really build on the work that she does and expand her philosophy. She has a wealth of experience in which she pulls from her work as a high-performance coach and creator-producer for the Life, Love, and Money Show. Let's go ahead and see lifelovemoney.com. And I'm particularly interested in her work as the founder of CORE and her research and efforts supporting military veterans. She brings a unique lens to this as a military spouse, so I have no doubt we're going to learn a great deal today. All right, let's get to this with Dr. Summer Watson. Dr. Summer Watson, so good to have you here on Saybrook Insights. You responded to the call of interviewing for me. It was greatly appreciated and looking forward to some time together with you on LinkedIn in the coming weeks. Maybe before we get started, tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you find your way to Saybrook University? What happened before Saybrook? So we have BS. I don't know if that's a good... but we have before Saybrook. We'll just put it out there. And after Saybrook.
Oh, I like that. So we always need to have a laugh, right? So that's a good one. So I think, you know, I was raised in California, born and raised in California. And I grew up in the 80s, so I'm going to date myself a little bit. I grew up in the 80s, and I always thought of myself as, you know, I'm going to have that big office with the window. I'm going to like have tenure somewhere. And, you know, that was my trajectory. I was raised by a single mom, and I thought, you know, I watched movies like Baby Boom, Working Girl, 9 to 5, all those goodies. And that's what I thought I was going to do. And I went off after graduating from high school and went off to Berkeley. I had a great time there. I experienced life. I lived life and I graduated. Then I went back home and I started working because I'm like, what am I going to do? I had one of those degrees that it's like, wow, what am I going to do now? So I thought, law school, that's what I want to do. And so I started applying for law school and I got accepted to Quinnipiac University in Connecticut. And so I went there, and shortly into that journey, I thought to myself, is this really for me? Is this an experience that I really want to go all in on? And I don't know if you ever saw The Paper Chase, but it's an old movie. It's about law school, and it's exactly that way. And I was uncomfortable every day. I had to think about it in terms of, does this really align with my values? Does this really align with my passion, my purpose, who I am? And as I was talking to other law students who were doing great, I thought, no, I don't know if this is really for me. And so I turned around and went home and I thought, I've never really done that. I've always like followed through on a plan. And so that was really tough for me. And nobody paid for that except for me because I had earned the money to go. And again, like I said, I was raised by a single mom and not really a participating father. And so I thought, well, okay, I'm going to go home and then what am I going to do? And so I had been dating somebody since senior year in high school and we were continuing to date. We ended up getting married 7 years later and we're still married today. And so he decided to go into the Marine Corps. And from there, I worked in San Diego. I worked in Sacramento. I worked all kinds of jobs. But when we were in San Diego, I got a master's degree. And I got a master's degree in human services with a specialty in community counseling. So I was starting to grow large collaborations. I was starting to work in community, bringing community together. I absolutely loved it. And I had two female supervisors. I had one who was doing more like the social work stuff with me and the other who was doing clinical work with me. So when I would go in to see, you know, clients who were individual clients, couples groups and so forth, I had those two mentors, which was incredible. Those female mentors were amazing. And so I worked in San Diego doing that. Then we got orders and we moved again and we moved to Sacramento. And I got a job working with the largest facility in the state of California, mental health facility in the state of California. So I worked doing assessments day in and day out, doing clinical assessments, assessing people who were homicidal, suicidal, gravely disabled, in and out, in and out, in and out. And I loved it. I loved it.
Well, before you go on, why did you love it? That sounds intense.
It was intense. And that's what I liked about it. I liked the fast pace. I liked the intensity. I liked that I'm not one to take a break, really. And so I just really loved it. And I love that I really appreciated that every person that was coming in had a different life journey, had a different lived experience. So, and that tracks to where I'm going with this. So when we moved, I thought, oh my gosh, I miss it so much that my husband was stationed in San Diego. I actually flew back and started working back in Sacramento, and we would fly back and forth seeing each other. And at that time, I was like, man, I have a master's degree, but my master's degree doesn't allow me to sit for a license, which was really interesting at that time. It will now, but not then. And so I was like, wow, what am I going to do? I really want a license. Either I go back for another master's or I go and try and get a doctorate. But this was the interesting part about it. Because I was a military spouse, I couldn't go to your traditional brick and mortar school. And I thought, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? I'm kind of locked in here and I need to find an option, an opportunity for myself. And that's when I started looking at different, not necessarily your online schools, but your at a distance school, your hybrid schools, where I could have that in-person experience, but also learn from a distance as well. And so I found Saybrook and I was like, oh my gosh, this is cool. I really like that you're in residence like twice a year during, you know, the different, what do we call them now?
Residential learning experience.
There you go. Residential learning experiences. And so I thought, I can do this. I can work this out with every move that we have outside of the country. I can really make this work. And even though if I had to live outside of the country and do it, okay, that would work too, because there were a lot of international students going there. And that's what I also really loved about Saybrook is that it gave me that flexibility. It gave me the opportunity to be able to achieve a doctorate that would allow me to sit for a license and do the work that I loved. So that's how I got to Saybrook.
Yeah, that's terrific. And during the course of your study while you were here, so you talk about the hybrid piece being appealing to you, that what about the environment for you made sense in your educational journey, your experiences that you had while you were here? What was good? What was electrifying, exciting, whatever, however you want to categorize it?
Okay. So it was a really great experience because, one, I loved being with other learners. Right. And so that felt really good because I was used to those traditional schools where I'd go into a classroom. So I didn't really want to give that entire piece up. So I was able to do that as these residential conferences and sit there and meet my professors and meet the other students and integrate with community and connect. And for me, that connection part is extremely important because that allows me to be more emotionally connected with people, understand their life experiences, their journeys, which leads me to something else down the road, and it has to do with Saybrook. But I also love the professors. I love the backgrounds from which they came. They were so diverse and so eclectic that we would have these great like opportunities to sit down with them at roundtables and learn from them. We've had these learning experiences in classroom environments, essentially, to learn with them. And so even at, let's say, a lunch period or a morning period, I would sit at a table with one of the professors, and we would talk about dream analysis. Or we would talk about something that really wasn't on my radar, but caught my interest. And I thought, well, this is something that's really interesting because I was able to explore something that wasn't necessarily as traditional as maybe the path that I was looking for. But at the same time, I was able to look at the classes and say, okay, if I want to correlate this my class schedule and what that looks like with maybe such and such course at a different school and get really clinical, I can do that there too. I can do that at Saybrook. And so I was able to do that at Saybrook while also infusing some really diverse learning experiences and the things that I learned, like shamanism or, you know, other things like dream work or, you know, and the professors that I got to work with, like Dr. Tom Greening, who was my dissertation chair, he was amazing. Or maybe there were other people that really contributed to my studies and my research. So Giorgio, what's his last name?
Oh, Amadeo Giorgi.
Amadeo Giorgi, right. So, and I read his book, which helped contribute to the qualitative research that I did at Saybrook. So I used a phenomenological approach. And so when I studied Edmund Husserl, there wasn't really a lined out approach to how to apply that to phenomenology. So when I was doing my research, I'm like, wow, we have Amadeo Giorgi, who is one of the leading practitioners of this practice of qualitative research, that I get to tap into his book. I get to tap into him if I need it. It was pretty amazing. And my research committee really worked with me to help, you know, to oversee that development of that protocol that I applied to my research. So that was really exciting for me.
That's so great.
Yeah.
You know, you're the first to bring up Amadeo Giorgi on this podcast, but for those in the audience who don't know, look him up. One of the real lions, a legacy in qualitative research, especially, but also just his general work in philosophy. Just super cool. So glad you brought him up, Summer.
Yeah.
Often forgotten, I think, as we get further and further away from that time period. So,
and that's really, really quite sad, because he had a lot of great information to contribute to the area of phenomenology in the qualitative approach of study and research. And so, and how to apply that to your research. So if somebody is looking at somebody's lived experience and really how to approach that through research, please don't forget about Dr. Giorgi, because he really has written a couple of books that really will help you during your application of your research. So
there you go. Love it.
Yeah.
Love it. So yeah. What was really intriguing to me are two things that I'd like to focus on today.
Okay.
And we can go in a different direction if you'd like to, but I was really moved by your work, especially your research around veterans and the military and your lived experience as a military spouse. You went 21 years plus 7 prior. And a lot of work and effort goes into that. We've had a couple students and alums who come from military families, you know, spouses and children of, and I think it ranges from fabulous, exciting to super challenging, and I don't know how I made it through X, Y, and Z. So maybe talk for a minute, because I'd like to hear your experience and then dive in a little bit to your research on the Iraq War and its impact on marriages. But take it away. Let's hear from you on that.
Okay. Well, about being a military spouse and living that lifestyle, because it really is a subculture. It really is a different culture. And prior to living that lifestyle, I was a very independent woman who had already, I felt like, lived a life. And Let's step back a little bit. I was raised by a very independent woman who raised me the same way. And so when I went out into the world to start exploring and living my adventures, you know, even in high school, she didn't keep me back. And she said, you know, Summer, if you're going to make a misstep, great. You're going to learn from that. That's wisdom. That's something to apply to your next steps. And I don't think she, as a young woman, was given that opportunity. Her parents really held the reins very tightly. And so she really wanted a different experience for me. And she allowed me a lot of freedom. And so with that freedom, a lot of parents today will be like, well, isn't that too much? Well, not, it wasn't for me. And yet I still did the teenage things. I still did, you know, had the silly missteps, but I learned too. And we didn't, it wasn't, it wasn't conversation that was taboo or I wasn't shamed for it. It was, let's have a conversation and talk about the consequences to, you know, the choices that you made, or let's talk about what you've learned from A, B, or C, right? And so I love that about my mother, that she was able to really set that foundation. And so as I moved through the world, and even as I got married and became a military spouse, my husband and I were friends, and we were friends before the military, 7 years before he joined. And so we had an idea of each other's personalities, how we communicated, how we functioned together. And then he joined the military. And so I knew him and I understood him. And I also understood, as we really got further into that military journey, how we were still going to communicate, but there were different factors that were going to influence that communication now. And those factors were the command, you know, the immediate command, the larger command, and the orders. And really at that point, I'm like, he doesn't really have a choice. And for me, that was really difficult. Like, okay, we have orders and we don't really have a choice where to go. And I'm like, oh no. How am I going to really understand this, really navigate through this, where it's going to fulfill me too, where I'm also going to have a purpose, where I'm going to, and that was hard. I will have to say, for 10 years, that was really difficult because I fought it for 10 years. I was like, man, I'm not an independent. And that's how they refer to you. You're an independent. You have a military card. That gets you around. That's the thing that allows you to do A, B, and C. And that, being called that dependent, or, you know, by the military, I'm like, oh man, that feels weird. And so I fought it and I was like, ooh, and that resistance. And my husband's like, man, she's going to fight it. But at the same time I was fighting it, I was still integrated into the community wanting to do things. And that's what was funny, because the spirit of who I am, I was like, I still want to help people. I don't care if you're in the military or elsewhere, but I was working with the Armed Forces YMCA and creating programs at Camp Pendleton. And I was building out programs so that we would reduce like issues where they would go off base, spend their entire paycheck in a weekend and, you know, get in fights or whatever the case may be. I was creating, you know, social programs on that base with the Armed Forces YMCA to really reduce that behavior. And so I really enjoyed that. I started working with the chaplain to really bring military spouses together, because the line of communication was, it wasn't great. And I'm like, how can we improve this? So I was looking for areas that I could integrate myself, my skill set, what I wanted to bring, and have purpose at the same time into that whole culture. And so as I continued on with that journey with my husband, I was like, okay, I'm going to still be myself. I'm going to still be able to do A, B, and C, but I'm going to do it in a different way. And each move, I got a job that either helps support the community or helps the military community or our civilian community in some way. And I really enjoyed it. And once I just let go and said, okay, this is it, right? I'm all in. Like, I'm totally all in. And that happened right after I graduated from Saybrook, because we got orders to go to Okinawa.
Oh gosh. Okay.
And I was hitting a wall. I was literally hitting a wall. And I thought, oh my God. And my husband said, stop. Because for a year I had looked for a job. And I've been working since I was 15. And I didn't know what to do with myself. And I'm thinking, I've lost my purpose. Like, what do I do? I can't get a job. And my husband looks at me and he says, okay, you just need to shop and play tennis. And I was like, okay, did you just say that to me? Like, do you know who you married? Like, and I'm like, wow. And I think he really just wanted me to like stop fighting, like stop really trying like so hard to find something that I wasn't going to find there, because we were on a little island and there were minimal jobs and there were other spouses who were very, you know, they came from all different backgrounds. They either, you know, were, women who, you know, were moms, or women who worked out of the home, or women who were doctors, lawyers, and they couldn't find jobs. And we were just like, wow, okay, we worked so hard up to this point. Now our professions are being impacted. So I began to, again, readjust, reorganize, and reassess. And I thought, so now what, Summer? So what are you going to do? And so I thought, well, I'm going to sit on a board. I'm going to help our community again, both the military and the local community, the Okinawan community. We're going to help raise funds for them. We're going to help, you know, them do A, B, and C. And so that's what I did. I started doing that. I started working with doctoral students who were doing qualitative research. I started my own business. I started working from a distance for other schools. And yeah, so I figured out a way. But during that time, too, my husband was deployed for a year in Iraq.
Wow. So you moved to Okinawa and then he gets deployed to Iraq. So you're now, maybe I shouldn't use this word, stuck in Okinawa.
Yeah. Yeah.
Shouldn't say stuck, but that's where you were at. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I was there. And what I learned is, and the military doesn't move you back. So they're not going to, uproot you and move you back to your home. This is your home. And so you wait and you hope that your husband's okay. And that was for a year. And I thought to myself, what am I doing here? Like, my husband's not here. I just graduated. I earned a doctorate. I don't want to say got, because it's, you earn it. And I thought, wow, I can't even put it into use here. And so what can I do? And it started making me use the other side of my brain, really. Like, how can I get more creative? So the business that I started had nothing to do with psychology, nothing to do with the clinical emphasis that I loved. It was making lamps. It was learning how to drill glass. It was learning how to, but at the same time, I was teaching other students and mentoring other students, in their qualitative approach. I was sitting on board. So there are other things where I was keeping my feet inside the community to be able to support them. So my husband gets back. We spend more time in Okinawa. We spend 3 years there. I get to travel the world, which is great. And then we come back. He stays in the military and he finally retires after 21 years. And at that point, I've done the research in 2004, 2005 regarding military families, and we were going to get into that. I know that was a question that you had to ask, especially because I was in it and I wanted to study what it was like for couples to really experience what it was like to be separated by war. And so that's what I did my research on prior to going to Okinawa, because I lived on a military base. I was watching it happen day in and day out. And I thought, wow, there are multiple factors that are influencing how we function, what those lived experiences look like, and how it's either separating families or how we're coming together.
What a journey in that space. I mean, and the ability for you to pivot as you did, the ability and the capacity you had to pivot in the way that you did is really astounding. I was just marveling as you were talking about, you have to be as a person, and I don't have this skill set. I don't think I could do this like what you were able to do. We've moved a lot as a family, but I don't think we've had to transition in all the ways that you had to. I know my wife has had some similar analogs, but how difficult that would be to go, to reset, to start over, and then kind of build all that up again. I can't imagine. So hats off to you.
Thank you.
That's the unheard story, I think, a lot of times of military spouses.
It is a difficult story. It is a challenge, because when you have this mindset of, this is my trajectory, this is what I want my journey to look like, and it is changed so drastically that that resiliency kicks into gear, right? And I have always been someone, my grandmother, my mother have said it, they've said, no matter what you've gone through, no matter how far down you've gotten, because you've had to shift so much, you've always come back. You've always figured out a way. And I think it's true. And I'm just thankful for that, because I never have that mindset of, oh, it's totally not going to work out. I'm just going to be down in the dumps totally. I can't stay there. I'm not the person to stay there. And I'm a person to recognize it, understand it, digest it, and then it's time to come up with a new plan.
Have the feels around it.
Yes.
But also come up with that plan. Yeah. Can you tell a little bit more about your research connected to that as well? In your experience with the doctoral dissertation, you talked about the Iraq war and its impact. You mentioned that just a couple minutes ago.
Yes.
What were some of the core findings from that, and how would you describe the impact that that may have had for other military folks who might have read it?
So I think the findings were such that, and what I love about research, okay, so you follow the traditional formula of the five chapters, right? And you kind of call out the factors that are impacting that your demographic. And some of the factors, and one of the main factors that were affecting them, was how is communication disseminated? How is communication effective? And communication was, it was huge. And it was a make or break situation for a lot of relationships, because a lot of times a military service member would give, it'd be given information and go home and forget to tell their spouse. Or it was, there's immediate information that is disseminated and you go home and tell your spouse and they're impacted and they don't know how they're going to function through the changes that are immediately given, right? Like these new orders, and you've got to like move really quickly. So there's all that. And then it's, how do you put that together? How do you put your research together that it will be, it will be understandable, digestible in pieces and parts where the community can actually take that and go, oh, okay, that's interesting. And what's really interesting, so I took this qualitative data and I took it to one of the entities I'm based in, and they said, we don't want to look at it. And I was like, okay.
Interesting.
Good enough. Okay. And so then I was like, okay, I'm going to have to shift. And how am I going to use this knowledge? How am I going to use this research to really influence and help, you know, other couples? Because I was seeing like 50% of those couples break up after deployment. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, wow, how can we do better? How can we do better as a community? And so it wasn't until years later, and I'll get to that in a little while, where I actually created with a partner, another military spouse, a military nonprofit. And so, but the people that were actually reaching out to me about the research were other researchers, because they hadn't seen the phenomenological approach put into practice from a qualitative perspective. So they were saying, hey, can we access your research to be able to look at your formula or how you used phenomenology as a research practice, right? How did you put that together? And I said, well, it was a lot of taking different resources, looking at those resources, and really aligning the resources with how I was going to actually lay out this research. And so, because Edmund Husserl, he never really gave that outline, that roadmap to how to apply it to your research. It was a theory, and it was a premise, and I loved it. I absolutely loved it, because it's really pulling from the lived experiences from the individuals that you interview and that you use for your research. And so I love that aspect of it. But the confusing part was, okay, but how do I put this into my research? How do I use this as a research component? And so the researchers out there were like, okay, and they were the ones accessing the study, because they wanted to know how to apply that. So it was, yes, the content was important. And yes, there was an outcome that could be applied to other military families based on our communication, based on distance, based on a lot of different things in how we function as a community, how we function as couples. But it was also very interesting that there were other researchers looking into the research, because they wanted an approach to using phenomenology as well.
Pretty rich, all things considered. I mean, all the challenges and roadblocks you kind of had along the way, too, it sounds like.
Yeah.
So, do you have any suspicions or musings as to why there was a lack of interest in picking up your research at the military level?
I do. I think there are certain organizations that oversee that kind of stuff, and they have other... You know, they have other people that they go to regarding research, and they have their own entities and units. And so they were like, no, not really interested. We've got things going on our own. But to me, that was short-sighted. I was like, well, why don't you just use all the research that's coming to you? Because this is new research. And when we do research, we want to look at the last 5 years of research. And so it's like, I was like, wow, I was shocked, but I wasn't. I was shocked because I've also heard from other spouses that they were treated the same way. Not maybe with their research, but there are other high-ranking spouses, so to speak, right? Or spouses of other high-ranking individuals that were like, yeah, we were treated the same way when we asked a question or when we asked for something. And I was like, wow, that needs to change because we have so many, just so many incredible women out there, so many incredible spouses, men and women, that are doing amazing things that the military needs. I think they should do more to embrace that.
Well, I think of the lost opportunities to really engage with that research in a way that could, to your very point, improve, enhance the lives of military, you know, officers, privates,
enlisted,
yep, all the above, and to try and make a difference in that lived experience. And I know the need is great. So shout out to you for doing that. I think to our military folks, take a page out of this book and hear what Summer Dr. Watson is saying on that front. So.
And I would say this too, and I want to add this, don't get discouraged when that happens. Just move on, like keep moving because it was discouraging because the vision is to always help people, to be able to support the community that you're in. And when you have this resource or you have this knowledge, you want to be able to contribute to your community, but don't become so down or so discouraged where you don't move forward. And so I continue to move forward and I continue to do things to both help the community because the community became really special. Because when I was in Okinawa, what I learned when my husband was gone is we came together like nobody's business. Like our military spouses came together. We supported each other. There were many of us who had husbands gone, who had spouses gone during that time. They were off to war. And from the commandant's wife of the Marine Corps to, you know, below, everybody below, we came together and we supported. We were a tight-knit community. And it was great to see. And it was great to have that source of support and engagement. And so there is always people there to be of support. And I don't want people to forget about that either.
Yeah, lifting each other up is so vital.
Absolutely.
So in our remaining, we have like a few minutes left. So we could go on and on. This is terrific.
Oh, yeah.
I really appreciate it. You are the founder, CEO of Core Women.
Yes.
And I was intrigued by this. We have followed each other on LinkedIn. But we also I've seen bits and pieces come through the Saybrook community here and there. Yeah. And I'm so glad we had a chance to talk a little bit about this today. So tell us a bit about Core Women. What is Core's mission, purpose, values? What is the kind of the feel that you're trying to go for? Who are you trying to serve? And do you have any good anecdotes for us about the work you've been doing?
Oh, absolutely. Thank you for that question. I really appreciate it because I do love the work that I'm doing. So when my husband got out of the Marine Corps, I decided that I would take a break and really reassess, regroup, and rebalance. And that means that I really needed to look inward and figure out what my values were, what my vision was, what my dreams are, and give myself some time because I had been following my husband's career for 21 years. And so at that point, I took a quick vacation with some really, really close friends, like four close friends, sorority sisters and somebody that I've known for a long time. And I thought to myself, you know, I really just want to figure out what I want to do now. And do I want to go back into the clinical field? Do I want to work for hospitals? Do I want to run departments? What do I want to do? And as I was with these women, I realized that as I watched them, and it wasn't the fancy dinners, it wasn't the going out, it was in a living room, and I watched them talk, and I watched them come together, I watched them be authentic, I watched them just share their stories, and as I did that, a light bulb went off, and I thought, that's it. It's been women who have helped me set the foundation for my life. It's been women who have been very supportive. Not that men weren't as well, but there are a lot of women in my life that have been really supportive. I want to give back in the same way. I want to support women and I want to bring them together. I want to bring them together through podcasts. I want to bring them together through seminars and conferences, both digital and in person. I want to do this stuff where we can grow together. And if we go back in history, there's been a lot of separation, a lot of historical reference to why we behave as we do towards each other. And I don't think we're quite as supportive as we could be. We could do better. And I, as a researcher, I decided before I jumped all in, I would do a survey. And I surveyed women and I asked them certain questions. And I said, do you have mentors at school or work? And the responses I got back for female mentors, the response was about 39% of the people that I surveyed, women, said no. I said, do you feel embraced by other women in a social setting? And about 45% said no. And I was like, wow. And the answers just kept coming back like that. And I was like, we can do better than this. And so I wanted to create Core Women, which is K. It starts with a K. So it stands for how we kinetically connect, how we move through the world, and how we connect as we move through the world, how we organically learn from one another, how we reshape our lives through diverse interaction, and how we empower each other to promote change. So that's what Core is about. And it's really a coaching business slash production company, because I produce podcasts and I produce these events. And through that, I've brought women together and we've learned from each other. We've explored different things. I've coached women in groups. So it's been a really incredible experience to be able to, one, you know, bring women together, but two, to also do something and create a business that I love.
How beautiful is that? I mean, social impact, connection, hits all the right notes. You're able to use your background in a beautiful way. That's just terrific.
Thank you.
So where can folks find Core Women on the web just before we get ready to wind down here?
So you can find it at korewomen.com. And you can also find me on Instagram. And you can find me at Summer Watson, MHS, PhD on LinkedIn.
Awesome. Awesome. So before we close out today, I ask this of all our guests, and this is the quick round, right? So first things that come to mind, don't invest too much, like, got to get this right. You got to get this being graded by the psychology faculty. No,
oh, no,
no, you're a doctor. So we're going to go with your definition. So the first question is, what does the term humanistic mean?
Oh my gosh, it means so much. So humanistic means really understanding the lived experience of the individual, of the group. And so to me, it means so much. And I've studied it for so many years from the beginning of my practices in the clinical field, studying Alfred Adler. And I really consider myself an Adlerian. And so through that, he was an individual psychologist. He deviated from Freud because he thought there was so much more than the psychosexual. And so from that, he thought there's so much more. And that means really we need to practice from a holistic perspective, a more humanistic perspective, understanding the point of discouragement for somebody. And so for me, a humanistic approach is really understanding all of those different facets of how we live our experiences and what does that mean to each of us. And that's why each of the jobs that I've been in, I've totally loved, especially in the clinical field, because everybody's different and I get to understand their human lived experiences.
I think that's an A-plus answer right there.
Thank you.
Good job. It's like you went to Saybrook or something.
Yes,
I did.
I know. So the last question we have, and we have gotten a range of fabulous answers. I don't think there has been a bad one or even a mediocre one yet. And I'm excited based on your background, what you're able to provide us today. What are three somethings that someone can do right now or in the short term to advance their own physical, mental well-being or create social impact in their community?
Oh, I love that question. So the first thing I would say is, you know, let's start talking more about mental health without shame. So there doesn't really need to be shame attached to mental health. Mental health is something that we need to start talking early about and being okay with it and having those open discussions and being very clear about our questions. So not just how are you, but how are you feeling today and what's impacting you? Like, get really specific about those questions, because I think as we want to help people, I think a lot of times we want to hear how are you doing? And we're expecting, oh, good. But let's, if we get more specific about our questions, I think we're going to get different answers. So that's number two. And number three, let's just start being really open and getting out there. And this is really important to me, getting out into community and reconnecting. And I think that during COVID, we were all in our houses. We were all, you know, taking space because we didn't want to get a virus and such. But I think it's time to get back out there and reintegrate and reconnect. And to me, that makes us more aware of how to be more emotionally connected. It starts really helping us trigger our emotion, not trigger, but really connect in an emotional way. And I think we've gotten away from that a little bit during COVID. And I think we need more connection. I think Zoom was great, but when you get in person, and you start integrating in person and understanding what that feels like and how you can be inspired, how you can learn from each other, that connection is so different in person. And so start reconnecting with people in person. I think it's a really, really needed thing today, and really to become more emotionally connected with people.
Amen. Dr. Watson, fabulous, fabulous job today.
Thanks.
Thank you for your time and for your service to our country, for your outstanding contributions as a scholar. We are grateful to have you here on Saybrook Insights.
Thank you.
Really fabulous connecting with you, Summer. Thank you so much. I hope you all enjoyed Summer as much as I did. Remember Dr. Watson's three major takeaways. Start talking about mental health without shame. Do it early and be okay with it. So sit in that and understand that mental health is whole health. Number two, being clear about our questions. Get specific. When you ask someone how they're doing, get a little deeper. Try and dig in and understand a bit more about who they are, what they're trying to work within, what they're managing. And thirdly, start being open and being out there in the world and creating community. If you want to see the YouTube version, please visit our Saybrook YouTube page. And if you'd like to support the podcast, go to Apple iTunes and leave that 5-star rating and review and subscribe so you can get episodes as they come out. If you're on Spotify, leave that 5-star rating and make sure to follow us. You can, of course, subscribe to us on most major podcast platforms, including Google, Stitcher, Pandora, and others. Remember to check our show notes for information on Dr. Watson, including links to websites, books, and the like. And for more about our fabulous, wonderful university, go to www.saybrook.edu, click on Areas of Study at the top of the page, and locate the program of your choice to learn more. Or simply Google Saybrook University. That's it for now, everyone. Thank you so much. Take care and be well.